You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
An interesting announcement from KEFI the other day relating to the Tulu Kapi gold project in Ethiopia. Here to tell us what it all means, Harry Anagnostaris Adams, the chairman. And so, Harry, what's the latest? What is happening there?
Well, the Tulu Kapi project was selected by us 10 years ago, and it was, repaired technically by us 10 years ago because the previous owners had left it in some disrepair technically. And then the country played up on us, cut a long story short. But over the last couple of years, the country has settled right down. Deregulation has opened up the opportunity to the level of banking standards. And therefore, this announcement marks, to our minds as the management team, what I would call the end of the beginning. And that means that all the pre-launch factors that had to be corrected have been corrected. And that means that we've now triggered various launch activities. And if I can sort of sequence them as best as possible, I would say that when you get something to the bankable stage, it says a great deal. You're talking of taking an excellent project with high grades, excellent environmental positioning, excellent social positioning, really waiting really for an inordinate amount of time to have been developed, and now it's bankable. And that says a lot because it's been through layer upon layer of independent checking and due diligence. That effectively has occurred over the last few months. It is bankable, and there are some formalities to go, but it's been nailed, if I can put it that way. So that announcement the other day really is saying that it's being bankable, it's having been banked, we have triggered the launch in terms of the preparations that one needs to launch. In fact, the monies we're spending today are really part of the capital budget, where we're spending money on security camps, construction camps, water supply, community property surveys. All these things are part of the launch and therefore in our capital budget, but they need to be spent now to ensure that we can commence construction and resettlement quickly. And that's what the announcement really spelt out in a bit more clarity than me just, chatting briefly. But the big things to me, when one looks at a project like this from a distance, the social license, you can do all sorts of things technically, but if you haven't got your social license straight, which means people, the community not only tolerating but actually promoting and protecting us and wanting the project to proceed. And we're in excellent condition there in that the property surveys for phase one have been complete, and the community is basically lining up for the launch for the resettlement, their resettlement and their job opportunities and so on. That's a very critical matter, which is difficult to convey, Alistair, in words, but, you know, thousands of people being consulted and expressing their support is, you know, is really quite the key to the project. The, you know, blanket of security that's been placed over the whole district, again, very difficult for words to convey that, but that has occurred and it is in place. And in terms of the, some physical activities like an initial construction camp and security camp and water bore expansion for water supply, things like that are in train. A road being built is in train. Procurement packages being prepared is in train. A last minute squeezing and negotiating of contract terms is in train. And having, if you like, nailed, as I said, the banking side, it's now time to nail the equity side, which is no mean task. You being an expert on the mining sector and particularly the junior mining sector, I no doubt have had your scepticism at times, Alistair. I've known you for long enough to know you probably looked at this saying, how the hell are they going to do it? I'm putting words in your mouth, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's how you felt at times. And not easy, but we think we've done it. And the reason is the government, first of all, squeezing the capital, the cost side. Secondly, contractors who want the work, they want to get into Ethiopia. Ethiopia might have been a scary sort of thing when it was playing up, but now it's 130 million people, the biggest hydro scheme in Africa. You know, a plethora of developments taking place as we speak. Contractors want to be in the country. So there's an opportunity for the contractors to have put some money up to get the job. Again, squeezing the cost, having the contractors play a role in financing, pardon me. You can't do that. You can't. That's one of the benefits of a frontier market. You couldn't get money out of a contractor to win a job in Australia because it's a thin margin, widely established sector. In Ethiopia, they're coming in for a higher margin, in a not well-established sector, and they're wanting to get their position. So we're getting capital out of that source as well. The government itself have put in, have committed already 20 million. They may put in more, we'll see. Again, that was for them to develop their own country and have a stake in a very important project, which today would be the largest export generator of the country if it was operating today. I think you're well aware that we're raising local capital. Now, that local capital is non-convertible, so it's non-ownership dilutive. But it's very attractive for the local institutional investor. So we're wrapping the project in local institutional investors as well, who are in a low currency, a low, how would I put it, a vulnerable currency jurisdiction, and here they get a US dollar linked investment and a gold kicker thrown in as well. For them, that's very attractive, but they don't dilute our ownership. So another quirk of being in a market like this is that we can raise equity risk capital on terms that are attractive for us. Now, if we're really lucky, everything I've said covers it. Now, we've had to fund our working capital. We've had to fund preparations for the full drawdown and full launch. That's clearly the case. And we've developed an inventory of minerals inventory of millions of ounces of gold, gold equivalent, across two jurisdictions. So obviously, that's taken a lot of capital in the past. But the projects on our books today are much larger than the projects that we've tackled before. And, you know, in context, the amounts of money being raised today are a drop in the bucket of the revenues that will be generated. So if we're lucky, we will actually have lined up the development capital in a way which is remarkably non-dilutive. And I'll be able to say to you, see, Alistair, we did it.
Yeah.
And of course, we are reviewing a holding in Saudi. We want to hang on. We don't really want to sell because we've done a fantastic job in a high growth country, in a new sector. But, you know, we hold no prisoners. We'll take no prisoners. We must close the deal in the least dilutive fashion possible. And that's what we'll do. So I hope I've given you a bit of colour around an RNS to give you a feel for it.
Absolutely. So you mentioned revenues towards the end of that explanation there. Let's remind ourselves a little bit about the parameters of Tulu Kapi. So you've got basically a million ounces in the bankable study or thereabouts, I believe. What's the plan? Production per year and margins and I believe the cash flow or the revenue, one or the other, is almost as much as the capex in the first year or might be.
Yeah. Well, the way we've sequenced our plans, it's quite important for an investor to click with how we've come at it. There's an open pit designed and planned to a bankable standard, as we've said, and the ore body continues down below. So we've designed the open pit to be, if you like, the underwriter of the whole gig, if I can put it that way. And we designed it at 1250 gold to make good money at 1250 gold. Now, obviously, that was, in retrospect, an overly conservative assumption. But it's been designed in that way quite deliberately. So it's got robust economics. When one picks the, if you like, the benchmark gold price to design the project around, it locks your pit design and your mine method, dilution, tolerance, a whole bunch of things in the way you design a mine. So that's been done tightly and robustly. Now, if you just look at that tight, robust, overly conservative, as it turns out, assumptions for its design, which we'll review in due course, but for the moment, let's just leave it as it is. It means that that operation will generate approximately 140,000 ounces a year at about $900 per ounce all-in sustaining cost. And its servicing of its capital, of its project financing debt, will suck up another $400 an ounce. So anything above about $1,300 will be for the owners, for the shareholders. What does that mean? It means that if it was operating today, at today's gold price, that bankable pit with all those conservative factors that banks like to apply and clip on it to make it, comfortable for their assessment, which generate a bottom line net cash flow after everything of about $240 million, which is more or less the same number as we're borrowing. So you had it pretty well right in that the net cash flow after everything of that bankable pit theoretically could repay all the debt in the first year. We'll go beyond that. We'll, during construction, we'll optimize the mine plan, tweak it. We'll do a lot of infill drilling to optimize the month-to-month budgeting. But the other thing we'll do as soon as it's practical, we'll decline down underneath the pit as well as optimizing the pit. And we'll get down there. We know there's already 300,000 ounces of gold and plus 5 gram ore down there. You don't need to analyze it any further to know we should get down there. And we'll drill it out, infill drilling from underground instead of spending the money from up the top. And we'll start the underground production and we'll follow it down. It keeps going. We don't know how far. It's a lot bigger. So, we'll very quickly move on to a combined underground and open pit operation because it's a much healthier way to run a pit with a combination of the two, with optimization of the processing plant, on the way through. So, I don't know if that gives you a sense of it, but that's the way I'd summarize it.
And what about the timing, Harry? So we're talking about the kind of all systems go as we speak towards construction. How long will construction itself take, and will there be a ramp-up period sort of after it's complete?
Yeah, well, so the sequencing we're going through now is that in December we had the agreed terms for the expanded facility, and in March the second bank issued its approvals, and we lined up all the documentation. So we had a package of documents. We had the second bank, the one that hadn't already approving it. And that meant that we could then trigger what you'd call the no turning back type steps. There are some steps that once you trigger them, you can't turn back. And that morally, the most important one is the community. If you trigger, which we have, the step of preparing the community for resettlement, you can't really turn around a month later or 3 months later and say, sorry about it, we didn't mean it. These people are on their ancestral properties, and it's all that they know, and they need to be treated properly with respect. So, having got to the end of March with banking approvals, in place and documents in place, which is what we'd said we'd do, we can then trigger the steps of community, security, physicals, equity. That means there's no turning back. And that's what we're in now. It's a 2 month process, what I just said, between those things. And then at the end of end of what do you call it? If you go through the exact 2 month sequence, because some of them have precise timetables, around the middle of June, you're at the end of that process of preparing, for instance, the construction contract. It is a quite a tight schedule on preparing a fixed price lump sum set of contracts with a hard set of numbers for a fixed price lump sum. And you can't trigger that too early because once you get the confirmation of the fixed price lump sum, you have to grab it while it's hot. Otherwise, you have to spend another $500,000, another 2 months refreshing it again. So we got to the end of March, things were in order with the banks and the documents. And so we triggered these social security contracting steps, which take a couple of months. So then you're in June and you all look at each other and say, anything left? Anything missing? Anybody let the team down? Whatever it is. And as long as we're all looking at each other and saying, I'm ready and you're ready and everyone's kept their word, there's a dozen syndicate members, there's $1 billion worth of contracting here. Between the OPEX and the CAPEX contracts, it's nearly $1 billion worth of contracting. And when we should not understate, KEFI might be a small AIM company, but the tasks that it is managing are not those of a small company. And one should understand the task set, the complexity of it, and the number of fingers in the pie to complete such a large task set. So there we are in the middle of June with everybody absolutely ready, right? Okay, then you got 4 weeks to sign up and trigger, they say. And that means that let's say you've triggered it all at the end of June or early July, all these bits to the whole thing, all have to sign up at the same time, one for all and all for one, or whatever it was with the Three Musketeers. And 24 months from that moment till full production, commissioning starts earlier, but full production 24 months from that moment. So that's the plan.
So that puts us into the summer of 2027 then.
Yes, for full production, yes.
170,000 ounces per year, you were saying.
The open pit is 140, and then when we bring on the underground, and if we have our druthers, that'll start up very quickly as well. But let's get the open pit nailed and everything nailed on the bankable plan, for better expression, and we'll go hell for leather to start getting down onto the underground as well and add that to it as quickly as possible.
Now, you were talking earlier about the conservative nature of the number used in the pit design, 1250 gold. Obviously, gold is very much higher than that at the moment. Do you, as a company, take any particular view on where gold might be when you come into production? Because obviously, at the moment, the margins are just looking phenomenal.
Well, from a company point of view, it's that expose that I gave you of how you start the design and how you go from there. What's driving that is what is the conservative gold price you start with for the design, and where we picked that number from was what was then the average cost of production globally. Why do we pick that number? Because it means that if the gold price falls below that number for any length of time, the industry will start shutting off its production. And so that's where it comes from. And if you look back for the last decade, the gold price has only been under that price for about 5% of the time. And that's the reason, because you'll kick back up again. Otherwise, mines will start being turned off. Now, today, the gold price has disconnected from the price, cost of production, because President Trump and other factors have increased the volatility and the scariness of the world to the extent that the role of gold as a refuge at times of higher risk has been resurrected very strongly at the moment. But from the point of view of designing the mine, when we come to refresh our mine plans and re-optimize, which we'll do next year, we're not going to assume that gold will sit at $3,000 in order to design the optimizations that we refresh. A banker today, a banker, and a banker, there's nothing in it for them to be optimistic, because they want to get their money back and their interest back. So they're a good benchmark, if you like, for conservative thinking. The most optimistic banker today that I know of is assuming $2,000 gold. The most pessimistic bankers I know of today are assuming 1500, 1550 gold. But they lag, lead and lag, just like the world generally. They all catch up eventually. And so, if you ask me where would we be re-optimizing, I should think that given the levers we can pull operationally to tweak the operation down and up if we need to, I should think we would be re-optimizing the mine around $1,800, $2,000 gold, around there. And to make sure you can go to bed at night and just sleep, You'll maximize your returns when you can, but you need to set a benchmark that you feel comfortable you can just sleep no matter what's going on in the marketplace. I don't know if that answers the question, but that's where we'd be coming at it from.
Pretty good answer, I think. Finally, Harry, before we wrap it up, I think you've given us some idea of what's coming, but what do you think will be the salient points of news flow over the next sort of 3 to 6 months from KEFI? You've mentioned quite a few things, I think, but tell us what they are in bullet format.
Well, there's actual preparations on the ground. I think anyone who has any modicum of exposure to operations like this know they're complicated and involve a multitude of tasks every day. So I think a continual reporting of developments on the ground is important, and that will happen naturally just because of the number of things that are happening. Secondly, the what we call the CP process, conditions precedent of ticking off various regulatory confirmations and so on. For example, I think KEFI shareholders are well aware that these banks are very large development banks, and in order to back a project in a new industry in a new, relatively new country for a modern development in mining, they get certain protections from the government enacted in Parliament. So they belts and brace their protections. One of them's already got it out of parliamentary ratification. The other one's got all the ministerial approvals, but is waiting for parliamentary ratification. We've been given all the assurances that we're going to get the parliamentary ratification. But obviously, KEFI doesn't control the Parliament of Ethiopia. And, we're given indicative timetables and indicative timelines, but we're in no position to dictate to the parliament of the country. But the country wants this project more than anybody, so we don't have any reasons to worry about that. But those are the things we'll announce because they are important milestones. And the process of the equity capital to keep updating people. I know sometimes it might seem a bit confusing because the person who's less familiar with the process of trying to optimize the mix might say, why can't they make up their minds and just finish it, Well, we're deliberately playing off various choices to optimize it, and the job's not done until you finish the job and optimize the choices, which is why it might be confusing on the way through. But for as long as shareholders are hungry to be informed, and it's not misleading anybody or breaching any confidences to keep people informed, we'll keep advising people how we're going. But over the next 3 months, they're the issues: the physicals, the CPs, and the equity. And then over the following 3 months, just sticking to your sort of standing orders for my answer, what you've got is community being physically resettled, the first phase. You've got procurement orders having been placed with factories all over the world to make the pieces. So if someone says, where's all the building? Well, in the first month, the building actually is in factories all over the world, whilst people are being moved on the ground to allow mobilization into the ground when the equipment starts arriving. So Tulu Kapi is a bit unusual. It doesn't have a lot of mining to do to get going, whereas a lot of mines, you've got a lot of waste material to clear, overburden, and people see all these yellow machines running around and say, see, it's all in construction, it's great. Well, Tulu Kapi is blessed. It has almost zero overburden. Within a couple of meters of the surface, you're into war. So we don't need to get it, we don't need to sort of start mining really until towards the end of the construction, other than preparing tailings dams and things like that, in preparation for operations. I don't know, does that answer the question, Alistair?
It certainly does. And we look forward to watching your progress, the progress that the KEFI team on the ground will make. And we wish you all the best with it. So thanks for talking us through all those issues today, Harry Anagnostaras Adams.
Thank you, Austin.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.